Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present a report on police suppression of protesters in Minneapolis-St. Paul who organized activities to demonstrate opposition to the Republican agenda at their national convention. George Sturzinger of the Renewable Energy Policy Project, who discusses the lack of federal support for the production of renewable energy sources. And Greg Dinier of the Change to Win Labor Coalition, who talks about why it is important for Barack Obama to articulate a populist economic message if he hopes to win a majority of American workers' votes in this November's election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former Nepal Maoist guerrilla leader Pushpa Kamal Dahal was sworn in as the country's new prime minister in late August. It marked a milestone in the democratic transition of the Asian country. The former rebel leader's nom de guerre is Prachanda, the fierce one. The Maoist faction surprised many by winning the plurality of assembly seats in the April election, but fell far short of a majority. Over the next 18 months, the assembly has the task of writing a new constitution. Nepal's bloody civil war ended in 2006 with a historic peace agreement. A violent insurgency killed over 13,000 people. Many questions remain about how to merge the National Army with the 20,000-strong rebel force of the People's Liberation Army, PLA. The PLA, inspired by Peru's Shining Path guerrillas, is motivated by the Prachanda Path, a mix of Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist political philosophy. While the new government's program is still vague, the new prime minister has promised land reform while accepting the idea of private investment. As Krishna Kanal of Nepal's Tribhuvan University observed, "The voters did not generally vote for the rebels' ideology, but for change. It became a fashion, a reaction to the non-performance of the other political parties." During his last 6 months in office, President George Bush is pushing an initiative that could make it much more difficult to regulate on-the-job exposure to toxic chemicals. According to the Washington Post, news of a new risk assessment initiative surfaced on July 7th when the Office of Management and Budget said it was reviewing a Department of Labor proposal that has not been made public. California Congressman George Miller, chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee, stated, "The fact that the Department of Labor seems to be engaged in secret rulemaking makes me highly suspicious that some high-level political appointees are up to no good." The powerful OMB last considered the question of risk assessment of workplace toxic materials in 2006 as part of an overall government review. The risk assessment plan was dropped after it was harshly criticized by the National Academy of Sciences as fatally flawed. Several months ago, a top Department of Labor political liaison, Deborah Miser, started working with OMB on a new risk assessment plan. The administration is looking to revise the rule that workers ought to be protected from daily exposure to toxins over a 45-year working life. Peg Seminario, director of health and safety with the AFL-CIO, said, "They're trying to reduce required workplace protections through a midnight regulation." The news magazine In These Times reports a growing number of moderate Republican state legislators are switching parties and joining the Democrats. Moderates are feeling squeezed by the GOP's hardline conservative stance on abortion and opposition to stem cell research. Suburban Seattle state legislator Fred Jarrett said he was leaving the GOP to stay in touch with his district, which is 70% pro-choice. Colorado State Representative Debbie Stafford switched parties to become the 40th Democrat in the state assembly, giving the Democrats a 15-vote majority in the formerly Republican body. Wisconsin State Representative Jeff Wood, who became a Democrat in early July, quipped that the conservative Republican Party continues to try to prove Benjamin Franklin wrong, trying to buy security by sacrificing liberty. Even suburban Westchester County, north of New York City, has become a tough place for Republicans. Yonkers State Assemblyman Michael Spano switched parties after his brother Nick Spano, a longtime Republican state senator, lost his seat in 2006 to a black Democrat. He blamed his brother's loss on right-wing social positions like trying to outlaw gay marriage. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
As Republicans in Minneapolis-St. Paul scaled back their nominating convention due to the arrival of Hurricane Gustav in the Gulf Coast, local police and FBI agents targeted activists who had come to the Twin Cities to protest against the GOP political agenda. Between the Lines' Scott Harris filed this report.
Beginning on the Friday before the Republicans convened their convention in St. Paul, gun-wielding police officers and sheriffs working with the FBI raided a number of homes and offices where they detained activists who were in town planning protests, as well as journalists and attorneys. Without explanation, police confiscated some political pamphlets, computers, and other constitutionally protected political material. On Labor Day, tens of thousands of demonstrators conducted a legal anti-war march from the state capitol to the Excel Center, site of the GOP convention. Police officers using pepper spray, rubber bullets, and concussion grenades indiscriminately attacked protesters when a self-described anarchist splinter group, calling themselves the Anti-Capitalist Bloc, were accused of smashing windows, puncturing car tires, and throwing bottles. Police in riot gear arrested more than 280 people, including journalist Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, and two of the daily radio show's producers, Abdel Kaddous and Nicole Salazar. The three have since been released, but still face charges. Spiritual activist Starhawk, a leader of many nonviolent civil disobedience actions in recent years, was in Minneapolis-St. Paul and talked about the preemptive police raids on activists.
The police raided the Convergence Center, which is the space where people were organizing, on Friday night. Our cluster was outside meeting in the park, and we came back and got a call that they were raiding the Convergence space. We were stopped outside on the sidewalk and not allowed to go in, but we could see people inside in handcuffs. And after many hours, they began letting people out one by one. We heard the reports that they had really burst in. They apparently had a search warrant but didn't announce it or show it, but just broke in through the doors, grabbed people, forced people down on the ground, handcuffed them. There's one young woman there who had a five-year-old child with her who was tremendously frightened to see his mother handcuffed and frisked and searched. They had a warrant supposedly for bomb-making materials, and of course they didn't find any bomb-making materials. The warrant apparently also included a variety of things, from nails to computers to electronic equipment to Xboxes, for some reason, were on the warrant. They did confiscate a lot of different property. Then over the next few days, they began raiding the houses of known organizers, and again, searching, confiscating things, arresting people. And that's sort of the kind of climate, the kind of atmosphere that we've been living in for the last few days here.
Sherry Hunkela, national coordinator of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, was also in the Twin Cities to bring attention to the plight of the poor and homeless in America through the erection of a Bushville shantytown and the convening of a truth commission. Hunkela comments on the conduct of police and the message she was there to send to Republicans and the nation.
There's been a whole, I think, preemptive approach. I've had five misdemeanors in 4 days, and I think that the goal is just to raid people, arrest people, and to try and make them afraid in order to cut down on the numbers of demonstrators, And in order to make the focus be on questions of protesters versus police, as opposed to concrete issues like the lack of affordable housing, the fact that people are dying because they don't have health care, the fact that 50,000 truckers have gone into bankruptcy in the last 2 months because of the high fuel costs. So I've been in all the major demonstrations for like 20 years in this country. And there's nothing compared to the kind of repression that I've seen in this last weekend. They've really crossed the line with not just, like, detaining people and engaging in unlawful arrests, but really messing with media. I just heard a few minutes ago that Amy Goodman was arrested. There's several other journalists that have been detained. Channel 5 news reporter was thrown into an elevator when he was trying to cover one of our demonstrations. And the list just goes on. And when we fail to have freedom of the press, we fail to have a democracy.
Well, finally, Sherry, I just want to ask you, what's the primary message you want the American people to hear around your protests in Minneapolis, St. Paul, around the Republican National Convention this week?
You know, our primary message is that we are no different than anybody else. We know many folks, including Republicans, are really hurting right now. We know that in Minnesota there was like 120 people last year that died while homeless. And we know many more are going to die that can't afford the high fuel costs this winter. And so our main message is to get involved, to participate, that together we can change what's happening in our country. And regardless of who's the next president of our country, we have a responsibility to take it back and take this country in a direction that values human beings and values human needs over corporate greed.
Tom Hayden is a longtime peace and justice activist, former California state senator, and a defendant in the Chicago 8 trial, where he and others were charged with conspiring to incite riots that erupted during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Hayden, who was not in St. Paul for the GOP convention, comments on police-protester conflict and the effect it has on political discourse.
The pattern you're talking about is very disturbing and very systemic and has been going on since Seattle caught the police and the law enforcement establishment off guard in 1999. What's alarming is the way that it's kind of come to be absorbed and made routine. It starts with the fabrication of information about anarchy and violence, much as the Iraq War was fabricated from the beginning as a pretext for the invasion. Nobody ever checks later to look at the veracity of this. So the threat of anarchy and rebellion and riot is systemically exaggerated. There's a campaign to scare the public. There are preventive detention raids. There are claims that weapons have been found. All this occurred just last week in Denver. What seals the deal is that St. Paul and Denver each get $50 million for high-tech police equipment from the federal government out of Homeland Security. So, you know, the budget for social services, including police, is going down, and the budget for Homeland Security is going up. So it's a complete package. Scare the public, good for the politics of law and order, and a way to get money for your police department.
As word gets out about the police suppression of protests in Minneapolis-St. Paul, a growing number of people across the nation have condemned what many are labeling police state tactics. Preemptive detention against political dissenters has become a familiar pattern of law enforcement behavior at large protests and has unfortunately been accepted as appropriate by too many in political power and those working in corporate media. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Over the past decade, federal production and investment tax credits for renewable energy have been passed in annual increments and often expired before they were renewed, making it difficult, if not impossible, for companies to invest substantially in these forms of energy that would reduce greenhouse gases that cause global warming and reduce U.S. reliance on foreign carbon-based energy sources. Efforts to extend the tax credits in Congress have failed repeatedly this year, as some politicians have held them hostage to a demand to allow offshore oil drilling as a way to expand domestic production. But just before breaking for their summer recess, members of both the House and Senate put forward similar bills that would renew the energy tax credits for 5 years and allow offshore drilling along some parts of the U.S. coast with restrictions like a 50-mile buffer zone from shore. In Barack Obama's acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention, he promised to tap natural gas reserves, invest in what he called clean coal technology, and safely harness nuclear power. He promised to invest $150 billion over the next decade in affordable renewable sources of energy, wind and solar power, and the next generation of biofuels. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with George Sturzinger, executive director of the Renewable Energy Policy Project. He discusses the lack of ongoing support for renewables and what needs to be done to make these energy sources economically viable.
It's been extremely destructive. I mean, the on-again, off-again nature has, I think, really hampered the sort of steady development of the kind of industry that you would need. So, you know, what you saw like 3 years ago was when it was re-upped for 2 years, there was this huge spurt in demand for wind and solar. And it, rather than leading to price increases, which is what you always expect when you increase the demand for something, you go down what's called a learning curve. What you actually saw was that the price doubled. And then that starts to choke off and sort of really hurt the development of the industry. So it really needs to be permanent, in my opinion. I mean, it's a classic case of, you know, if you have something on again, off again, and all of a sudden you want to jam full speed ahead, you don't have the capacity. You want a really long-term commitment. You want a signal to the industrial sector that this is going to be there for a long time. They respond to that. They build capacity, and the capacity is used to meet the demand. But instead, you got a real spike in demand with no capacity, and the price goes up, and it's just a very, very, very bad way to run an industry. You know, I think it was all part of the kind of walking away from renewables that occurred during the Reagan years in mid-80s through the mid-90s. And part of that was there was no environmental cause for the development of these technologies, and the fossil fuel prices declined precipitously during that time.
George Sturzinger, can you give us some measure of the capacity of these renewable energy industries?
In the United States, there are 16,000 megawatts of wind already installed, and that would be between $30 and $50 billion of investment in the ground. If we really are going to stabilize and reduce carbon emissions from the electric sector, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. The solar industry, if you look at what they think they can do, they're pretty confident that they can beat wind. And, you know, you have people in, you know, recent news out of California, there's 800 megawatt solar project that has made it past sort of the first hurdle. And 800 megawatts, that's 800,000 kilowatts, you know, and a kilowatt of solar is probably around $3,000. So you're looking at a huge project right there, and you know, if the solar industry is right, I mean, that also is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of new demand. So it's a big industry. I mean, it's a big industry, and or potentially a big industry, but it is still suffering from a kind of, you know, we have made a rhetorical commitment to do a lot of stuff, but we haven't really sat down and done the hard work of putting in place the kind of permanent incentives and research and development programs that you really need to move seriously down the road.
Can you give us some idea of what amount of renewable energy is needed, for example, to power a home?
Typically on a residence, if you put a solar panel on your roof, it's between 2 and 5 kilowatts. So you're providing like 20 to 35% of your usage. One wind turbine now, which is 1,500 kilowatts, you know, could serve part of the load of 300 houses.
I think last year there was a growing concern among Americans to reduce the use of fossil fuels that contribute to global warming. But now all the concern is just about the price of these fuels and the desire to find more supply. So given that situation, can you make the case that renewable energy is economically viable?
I think that it is absolutely critical to make real progress on a serious climate policy. I think you need two things. One, you have to have a program that people actually believe can be done, you know, that you can understand, we can make this and we can do that and actually can work. And it has to be affordable. I think you can make a case that a serious set of policies that develop the industrial capacity to really move ahead with these plans could make renewable energy that was manufactured here that would revitalize those communities and be cheaper than the alternatives.
That was George Sturzinger, Executive Director of the Renewable Energy Policy Project. Contact the group at area code 202-293-2898 or visit their website at repp.org. As this year's presidential election campaign moves into high gear, one of the Democratic Party's most loyal and dependable constituency groups is organized labor. But unions have seen a steady decline in membership in recent decades and have been under attack by the Bush administration over the past 8 years. According to a recent poll conducted by Lake Research Partners and released by the Change to Win Labor Coalition, American workers are looking to support a presidential candidate who is not controlled by big corporations, supportive of progressive tax reform, limits corporate power, and advocates workers' rights. The survey found that working families want to preserve the American dream by guaranteeing affordable health care for all and government action to protect retirement benefits and international fair trade agreements. While the leadership of the AFL-CIO and Change to Win Labor coalitions both strongly support Democratic candidate Barack Obama and his positions on issues important to unions, the race is tight among white workers, with many supporting Republican candidate John McCain. The 10-million-member AFL-CIO, made up of 56 unions and Change to Win, a partnership of 7 unions with 6 million members, plan to spend a combined $300 million on voter registration, issue ads, direct mail, get-out-the-vote operations, and other campaign activities to convince their members to vote for Obama. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Greg Denier, communications director with Change to Win, who talks about why it is important for Barack Obama to articulate a populist economic message if he is to win the majority of workers' votes in this election.
I think what's happening in the country is there's a tremendous economic power imbalance. There's a power imbalance in the workplace, where even though workers work harder, and this is one of the central numbers, central economic numbers everyone should be aware of, is that productivity has been going up and up and up, meaning workers are producing more and more wealth. But that wealth is going less and less to workers. The wealth they produce is going into profits and CEO compensation, and less of it is going into paychecks. So even though productivity has gone up, workers' wages have either stagnated or actually fallen. So we're working harder and we're getting less because corporations, employers have so much more power than workers. They're able to take all the wealth workers produce and keep it for themselves. The other number people should look at is that union density or the percentage of workers in unions in the private sector has fallen to 7%. As the percentage of workers in unions falls, income inequality goes up, because workers don't have the bargaining power to take their fair share of what they produce. So on this Labor Day, we're committed to renewing the American dream by giving workers a chance once again to be able to form unions, to be able to have some sort of balance of power in the workplace and in the economy. And that has to go to the Employee Free Choice Act, which, again, would remove barriers to workers forming union, remove employer intimidation, threats, and coercion, and allow workers to form unions. And that really is central to economic renewal and recovery in this country. Because a top-heavy economy doesn't grow. It just sinks. And I think that's what we're seeing today, is that all the wealth goes to the top. And when all the wealth goes to the top, the economy falls over. It collapses. We need broad-based distribution of wealth to put money in the hands of workers so they can buy what they produce, so that we have economic growth, so that we have well-being for our families. And workers can't do that unless they're able to have some power in the workplace in order to negotiate the wages and benefits they deserve.
Greg, there was a piece written in the Washington Post recently by Harold Meyerson, who wrote that most union members back John McCain and not Barack Obama. I guess there was some assertion there that race is a fairly large factor here in terms of white male voters, and that would apply, I guess, to everybody, including union members. What do you see as the obstacles now to getting a good turnout in this election for your preferred candidate, Barack Obama?
Well, I don't think that the majority of union members support John McCain. In fact, I haven't seen a single poll that shows the majority of union members supporting John McCain. What we did see in our poll, that amongst white voters, there was a split where people had not yet committed to Barack Obama and also had not yet committed to John McCain. I think that's where we're talking about. You have to have a clear message of economic populism, because the people who are strongest on the economic issues, the voters who feel most strongly on the economic issues, are white working class voters. They're as strong on those economic issues as African American voters or Latino voters. What they have not yet seen is a message coming from a candidate that has convinced them that those issues will be addressed. Of course, I think that among some voters, race plays a factor. But I think that a strong message of economic populism certainly can overcome residual feelings of racism in this country that will influence the vote. But there are some people in this country who are going to vote on a racial basis, and Barack Obama's campaign, we as the union movement, have to mobilize people to overcome that.
How much of an obstacle do you think corporate support for the Democratic Party is to really developing and refining the economic populist message that you say is so important to winning votes this time and developing policies that help average Americans in the future? You see that as an obstacle here?
I see that as a challenge that we have to overcome. We can work positively with corporations. You know, we can work we do in the workplace all the time, work positively with corporations. We can work positively on an agenda for national health care reform. We can even work positively on an agenda to reform labor relations in the workplace. But workers must have an equal seat at the table, and they must have a powerful voice. The mistake that labor has made in the past, that was when the election was over, we went home. For us, this time in Change to Win, Election Day is the first day, not the last day, of our political program. We will begin the day we elect Barack Obama to push our agenda and to push our program. And we're willing to work positively with allies, including corporations, to come up with an agenda to restore the American dream. But we're not going home after Election Day. We're not going to leave it up to the President or Congress. We are going to continue to mobilize to push for our agenda. And that really is a difference from in the past.
That was Greg Dinier, Communications Director with the Change to Win Labor Coalition. Contact them at area code 202-721-0660 or visit their website at changetowin.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.